I'm Andrew Ingram. I'm an alcoholic. Sober since October 26, 1997. I said there was a lot of food on the couch. I didn't say it was stinky. So in the middle of the night, I'd get up and I didn't have to go anywhere. I'd just munch away. God bless you, Mary. Wherever you are. Bob came up to Alaska shortly after that, and I woke up in the morning to see him on his knees praying in his underwear. And I thought for a minute he had one of my carpets on his back. But it's not that cold out. I wonder why he did that. That'll wake you up in the morning. I want to thank John for asking me to speak. He called me at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up and ran to answer the phone, because I'm never up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And he asked me, and I thought he was kidding. I guess he's not. Guess he wasn't. But this is the mecca of AA conferences, as far as I'm concerned. It's the first one I ever went to, and as a result of the recovery group. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the recovery group, if it wasn't for John, if it wasn't for Jim, if it wasn't for them. 12-step and my sponsor, Brad, who carried this message to Alaska. I'd been in a lot of meetings. I'd been in a lot of treatment centers. And the message was never clearer than when I got to rooms like this in Wasilla, Alaska, of all places. And that's not where I'm from, so it was a little strange that that's where it happened. So I'm so grateful for this event. This is my sixth time at Beartooth, and I hope to keep coming back here till I die. I mean, this is the best conference out there. You guys have done a great job. I'm not a crier, but after listening to John and then Cindy, I might turn into one. Gosh, John covered everything there is to cover, you know. The before and after, and then Cindy's just funnier than hell. Wanting to kill John and being 12 and being a Benny Rooster. That's the funniest thing I ever heard in my life. Going around pecking everything. Bob's been awesome. Just awesome, man. He's gave me all the little hints and tips and when to show up and how to show up. And got me water and coffee, and he's just been wonderful. A cooler, a Diet Coke, and it's just like I've never been treated so good, and I really appreciate it. Just get right into my story. You know, I was raised by two very loving parents, and I was raised very well. I was only hit one time, and it was long overdue. Let's put it that way. My dad had just finally cracked under the pressure, man, and just whacked the crap out of me. And I wasn't even mad about it. It was like I was thinking he should have hit me years ago, you know. I was a dork. I was just a goofy kid. And in grade school, I had a really funny haircut. It looked like a helmet, you know. It kind of come down like this and just kind of chopped off right here. And my pants were always too tight for whatever reason. And I always felt out of place. I moved a lot. We moved a lot as a kid, and I don't know that that really had anything to do with it, because I've always been fairly outgoing, but I was just, you know, I'd get depressed. I'd just clam up. I was just kind of a, you know, manic depressive, I guess you could say. You know, sometimes I was on top of the world, and other times I just couldn't talk to anybody. You know, my mom would just be like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And I just wanted her to get away from me, and I didn't know why, and I didn't understand why, and it seemed like I got to school and everyone had seemed like they'd been friends since birth. And I always seemed like I was on the outside looking in. And finally had my first drink. It was long overdue. I was in seventh grade. Me and two friends drank 3 40-ouncers, an Old English 800. And I had mine and I finished it. And that was it for me. My life had changed at that moment. I got done drinking that 40-ouncer Old English 800. And my hair got nice and I got cool all of a sudden. And I just couldn't wait to get around some women. There weren't any when we were drinking, but I just couldn't wait to get around some women, and it changed me. It changed the way I was. Even the next morning I woke up, I was sober, but I knew that I could get that feeling again if I had just found some alcohol, and I knew that my life had changed forever. It seemed like everyone that had told me not to drink, and people had been telling me not to drink because there's a lot of alcoholism in my family, not my parents, but my uncle. I have uncles and dead uncles who died, their liver blew up on them, and all kinds of crazy stuff. One uncle who changed his name to Barney, and he's running around in Tennessee somewhere under an alias. If you run into him, ask him how he's doing for me. He's just alcoholism in my family, and they saw it in me as a young kid. They knew it was going to happen. They warned me about it, but after I drank, the way that I felt, it was so much better than the way that I was when I was sober. There was just like night and day. There was no difference. I don't know if it was a conscious decision or an unconscious decision, but I was going to drink every chance I got after that. And I believe that once that alcohol hit my body, I became alcoholic. As soon as that alcohol hit my body in that 40-ouncer, that was it. I mean, that bottle was getting finished. There was never, should I finish it? You know, that question never popped up. I just finished it. It was like we were one, you know, and that's how it was for me. It changed me. I was such a misfit, you know, and it's like I'd go to these high school parties and I was a fly on the wall, you know. I'd just stand there. I wouldn't talk. Every once in a while I'd talk to maybe a close friend. Now that I drank, I'd drink before I went to these parties. I'd walk in the party and I'd look around the room and I'd just think to myself, who is the lucky lady tonight? Because someone's getting lucky. And I was still, it was just a perception thing. I just felt like I was somebody after that. And I felt like people wanted me. They probably didn't, but that didn't matter. That didn't slow me down. And I started getting into trouble right away with my drinking. I started stealing car stereos at night, next thing you know, to pay for alcohol. And next thing you know, I'm in juvenile hall. So my freshman year in high school, every weekend I had to check in at after school on Friday. Luckily, the football games were on Thursday my freshman year. I was big into athletics. I was, at that time, had been quite the academic. I was in this international high school program where I'd got college credits, and so I was planning on getting out of high school and having college part of the way done, and that fell by the wayside in a hurry. My sophomore year, I had to find other ways to get alcohol besides I didn't have enough money to pay these bums, you know, and give them their cut to go and get me booze, so I had to figure out other things. So we'd go to the DMV, and we'd steal laminations from the DMV and make fake IDs. And so I was, just before I did that, there was this Vietnamese, convenience store. And I went in there and I put a couple cases on the counter and they asked me if I had ID and I said no. And at that time they had this, you know, proof of age form you could sign. I was like, where do I sign? You know, I'm 21. I promise you that. And I got the cases and left, but then that, you know, pretty quick that fell by the wayside, so I had to start making fake IDs, and I got sick of getting alcohol for everybody all the time, so I started selling them to, you know, 20, 30, 40 people at my high school. Next thing you know, the cops are coming into the classroom, cuffing me in the classroom, hauling me off for falsifying government documents and all these other charges that they had. I got in trouble a lot in high school. I got, you know, shortly after that, I got my first arrest for inciting a riot. And there's more to come. I just never liked to do things alone, you know. I was always wanting to do things with a group of people, and so that was the first one of many to come. Well, only three. And a little while after that, football was my thing, you know. It was one of the things that kept me in high school. Otherwise, because I was drinking by now, I'd drink at school. I'd drink when I got out of school, you know. We always had wild turkey before football practice because we had an insane coach and we really never learned how to play football. We'd just get about 20 feet away and run at each other as hard as we could, you know. So we'd have to drink a little wild turkey before that because those upperclassmen were big and I was playing varsity. So I did that. And then my senior year, I'd lettered my junior year. It was finally my turn to really shine out on the football field. And couple weeks before daily doubles, I was at a friend's house and we shared a half gallon. We started got up early that morning. He's got up about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we had that half gallon done by about noon. And we called another friend of ours, Eric, and we're like, "Come over, come pick us up. We want to go ride horses." So we came over, and I'd never ridden a horse before, except for one time, it bucked me off somewhere. I'm a city guy, definitely not a horse guy. So he came over and picked us up and took, and supposedly there was this tiger, this circus tiger there, you know, and I got there, and there was this circus tiger there. So I ran right over to this tiger and drunker than hell, and we'd just been eating a whole bunch of chicken on the way over, and I put my hand up to the cage like this, and it was licking me through the wire mesh, and his tongue was about a foot long, you know, and I was just like, wow, this is a really nice tiger. So I reached my hand in the cage to give it a nice little pet, and it grabbed a hold of my thumb, clamped down on it, and next thing you know, it's trying to drag me through the fence. I got my feet up on the fence, pulling as hard as I can, and my buddy Eric comes running over and starts punching in the nose as hard as he can, and he's punching, and I'm pulling, and finally the end of my thumb just pops off, you know, and I go flying back, and I don't know what to do, you know, and he's like, I couldn't even believe it happened, and I'm just drunker than hell. And these people that live there at this house are just mortified at my insanity, and they're mad at me, and I'm thinking, why are you mad at me? It's your stupid tiger that bit me, you know, and they're upset, and so they give me a bowl to bleed in. So I'm bleeding in this bowl, and they drive me to the emergency room. My mom works in the emergency room one more time, you know, and she's, you know, God, Andrew, how much did you drink today? Two beers. I mean, you alcoholics know that's written into our DNA. Two. Every time. Two. Never three, never one, never six. Two. When we're lying. And so anyway, then they're like, you know, what bit you? And I said, you know, it was a dog. It was a stray dog. Because I knew if they knew it was a tiger, they'd go, and it'd be even. Their people were already mad at me that, you know, I let their tiger bite me, and so I said it was a dog, and so now I have to have all these rabies shots because it's a stupid dog, and then the animal control comes over, and they want all this big report from me, and they want to drive me all over town. So the next 3 days, we're trying to find this infamous dog that bit me, you know, and that's just the way it goes with me and my lies, you know. They just stack up and they cause me great grief, you know. That driving around was cutting into my drinking time. So now I'm at Daily Doubles and I got this, you know, ball of cast on my hand. So now I can't be a running back like I had hoped to be. Now I got to be a defensive back. And so I just clubbed people all year. You know, it really, really sucked because I hate defense. I don't like hitting people that much unless I'm drinking. And so, you know, 18th birthday rolls around. I'm thinking, you know, right now I have just a litany of felonies on my record from being a drunken juvenile, you know, and I can't wait to get those expunged. I'm thinking I'm going to start a new life when I turn 18. And 18th birthday, Jack Daniels, shots of Jack. We're pounding them down, and then we go to this teen dance club, and there was no alcohol there, so we immediately left, went looking for a bar. On the way, these four people tried to run my friend over. I'm sure he wasn't doing anything to deserve it, but anyway, they all got out of the car and jumped on him, two guys and two gals, and I'm throwing these gals off, and then me and this guy are in a fight, and I get him down in a headlock, and next thing you know, I'm getting hit with a stick from the police, and I'm in a drunken rage now at this point, and they are trying to cuff me, and I'm trying to break through the police line to get at this guy because I'm not done with them. They find, you know, and so they're whacking me with a stick. Finally, they get me down, get me cuffed, throw me in the back of the car, driving me to jail. And then all of a sudden, the reality of what's happening sets in, and I'm like asking the officer if he wouldn't mind just stopping and letting me out. He wasn't going to do that. So I'm in jail, and I immediately get into a fight with this big old biker guy in the jail cell. And the cops saw that, and they thought that he must have started it because of the way he looked, you know. So they'd come in there and beat on him a little bit and haul him out of there. So I don't know. It was that was it, you know. I got charged with a bunch of stuff, and I was just like, screw it, you know. It's just one more in a series of bad things that really don't amount to much in light of how alcohol makes me feel. You know, I didn't consciously realize that was a situation, but now I do. Looking back on it, I mean, I had to have major, major consequences for my drinking to slow down, and nothing like that was going to slow me down. Night in jail, so what? You know, I have to drink. And by this time, sober means misery to me. I wake up and I feel like I don't have any friends in the morning. I'm freaked out about what I did to who last night, and I always have these, you know, time release brownout things where I like remember bits and pieces of the night before, and none of it's good, you know. It's not necessarily the good part, so I just can't wait to get Got this job shortly after that as a warehouseman. I had big plans to go to college and do something with my life. That never came close to fruition. And so I was working at this warehouse, and you couldn't drink like you could in high school at this job. So I'd have to smoke weed, which I wasn't, you know, I don't like smoking weed. I just do it to because I have to. And so I'd me and my buddy Todd, who was the biggest pothead ever, this guy still to this day blows glass bongs and pipes and everything, you know, now, and he loves it. He's happy, so whatever. But we'd get up and smoke a bunch of pot first thing in the morning, you know, and the 10 o'clock break at work would roll around, and I'd just run to 7-Eleven and eat about 3 chili cheese dogs and grab a bunch of potato chips and pop, and I just couldn't eat enough on that stuff, you know, and I just couldn't wait to get off work. And I'd get home, and by this time I was living with this girl who I was just, you know, started out, we were both paying the rent, and then pretty quick she was paying 75% of it, and then pretty quick she was paying all of it, you know, just one more time. I'm just a, you know, you let me take an inch and I'm going to take a mile every time, I tell you what. And I was doing that, but every night she'd have a half rack of Budweiser sitting in the fridge when I got home, and it was like, that was heaven to me. That was what life was all about. My life had been reduced to that. That was the whole key to my existence, was getting home from that job, grabbing a glass, dumping that whole can in the glass, and just drinking it down. Doing that 3 times. By the time I got to my 3rd one, I just finally could just lighten up, loosen up, let a little bit of steam off. I mean, that was like, that was all I could do to function after that, you know. And I was drinking every single night, and on the weekends, it was pretty much just a drunken blur all weekend long, and it got to the point where I had to drink during the day. I got in a big fight with my boss about it, walked off the job, and I had to look for another source of income, so I started selling drugs, and I started out selling pot, and then I was selling meth and coke and heroin, everything I could get my hands on, basically acid. Get up in the morning and start drinking. It was like magic, you know. I wasn't from that old, you know, the old people like my dad who would get up. I don't know how to say that nicely. He would get up and work no matter what. I mean, just no matter what, he would just get up and go to work. There was nothing that slowed him down. And for me, it was like, I just felt like a wiener. I just wasn't tough enough. I just had to get up, and it's like, all I could do is just, I'm just too emotional. You know, I just need something to drink first thing in the morning. And then, so this selling drugs thing was the key to that. It solved that problem, because now I could get up in the morning and first thing out of bed, man, something good, like Pabst Blue Ribbon or Bush beer or something like that, just to get the day started. And so I was doing a little of that, and pretty quick I have these army investigators show up from somewhere in some base in Washington, and they have some issue with me doing something regarding dealing drugs to different army bases throughout the country, and whatever, you know, it's one of those things. And I actually, it freaked me out. I mean, it really freaked me out, because it was, I mean, I was looking at some pretty serious prison time for that, and I had big plans for my sex life, and that wasn't in it. That wasn't the kind of sex I wanted to have. Tell you what, I'm not a big tough guy, you know. I always acted like it when I was drinking, but I was in jail. That would have been horrible. And so I left the country. I packed up and went to Jamaica, and I was living in Jamaica. And Jamaica is awesome. Jamaica is a place for alcoholics. They made Jamaica for guys like me. And I would get up in the morning, and I'd get a case of Guinness, warm Guinness, which I had already developed quite a taste for. And that was pretty much what I drank. I drank Guinness all day long, and then I'd have these little fruity drinks at night while I listened to these bands and hang out on the beach, and there's naked women everywhere. And I mean, it was magic, you know, except for the fact that I just knew I'd have to go back to the States and face the facts one of these days. And so I had some contacts back in the States and an attorney and a few other things, and one thing led to another, and somehow, some way, they didn't press charges, and I was able to come back. And it was one of those situations where I thought my life was over, and I basically sweared off dealing drugs, but not drinking. I mean, I really hadn't gotten that far. There was no way in heck I was going to stop doing that. But I'd gotten back, and my alcoholism had just really turned on me to that point. It was to the point where it was just like, these people that I'd sell drugs to just didn't even, I mean, it was better for them just to not have drugs and have me come around their house. Because it was just like, I brought trouble everywhere I went, you know. I was always drunk, I was always loud, you know, I'd always yelling obscenities and, you know, getting in fights, and the police were always following me. I started to get arrested on a regular basis for bar fights, and people would call the cops on me for this or that. So every, you know, 2-3 weeks a month, they'd come by and pick me up and haul me off to jail again for just little things, you know, nothing big. One time it was, my dog had gotten out, and they put it in the pound, and I went and got it, and they wrote me a ticket, and I never paid the ticket. So one time I got arrested for a dog at large ticket that I never paid. Anyway, it was getting to the point now where people didn't want me at their house. I mean, I had, you know, I was staying on people's couches, and real quick, I wasn't even doing that anymore. I was looking for a shed to sleep in. I was homeless. My parents had changed the locks on the house. Not that I ever went there. I mean, as soon as I started drinking, it was like something told me I better stay away from home. But they thought just maybe, because they knew that I was up to what I was up to, that just maybe they should change the locks just in case I did. And basically, my dad had kind of tracked me down at this point and was interested in helping me. And he basically talked me into going to this treatment center, Serenity Lane in Eugene, Oregon. And I went to this treatment center, and they gave me this long 100-and-some-odd, you know, question assessment. And I tried to slant that thing towards drugs as much as I possibly could, so they'd say I was a drug addict. Because I've quit drugs, you know, many times. In fact, most of my drinking, I didn't do drugs. I just drank. I only did drugs, you know, mostly because it was the polite thing to do with the people that I was around. You know, that and the blackout stopped. And so I did this assessment, this questionnaire, and they got to the end of it, and they said, "You're an alcoholic. You are an alcoholic, and you need to get checked into inpatient treatment immediately." And I fought that thing. I mean, I was out of there. There was no way I was going to do that. I'd try your outpatient is what I basically ended up telling them, and that's all I was going to do, period. And, you know, the felonies were stacking up, and the court appearances were stacking up, and they, you know, they wanted me bad in there, and I was just like, I needed to do something to get the heat off. So I did outpatient. I'd show up there Monday night, and I'd get up Monday morning, I'd do my darndest just to not drink, and 4 o'clock in the afternoon would roll around. I just couldn't take it anymore. So I'd have to have a drink. And then I'd show up to that outpatient treatment, and they'd turn me away. They'd say, "No, you have to be sober." Like, that's what I'm here, you know, to stop drinking. They didn't get it. They sent me away. And come back next week, same thing. And finally, I just surrendered. You know, I was just like, you know, I shouldn't be homeless. I shouldn't be having, you know, suicidal and homicidal thoughts all the time. I can't stand myself when I'm sober. I'm miserable. My family hates me. And all the stuff that I had done up to this point, you know, a lot of which I don't share from a podium, was just getting to the point where it was really, you know, taking its toll when I was sober. And I'd have to stay drunk just to get my head to shut up, just to get those thoughts out of my mind. And so I finally went, I checked into treatment. I didn't realize what I was missing. That place is great. They chalked me full of Ritalin as soon as I walked in the door, and there was beautiful women everywhere. There was great food. The best chefs in Eugene, Oregon were there cooking us up 3 hots a day, and we'd go to the YMCA in the morning, and we all sit in the hot tub before, you know, we'd start our classes, and treatment was wonderful. I loved it. I didn't have to do anything, you know. I just pretty much just went to the next thing, and I was made for treatment, you know. They'd fill me full of pills, and I'd get out, and they would definitely motivate me to stay sober. And I'm sure they mentioned going to AA, and I tried AA before. I'd been to a meeting or two here and there. I'd get out of treatment. I'd do their outpatient. And then I'd go to AA. Well, I'd get out of this treatment center, and I was doing basically AA once a week, and I'd go to 3 of these outpatient meetings a week, and after 2 weeks of that, 3 outpatient treatment meetings, and one of them was family night. And after 2 weeks of that, you know, I was sitting there at family night, which I think is a bad idea, family night at treatment. I think just family's a bad idea, period, when you're new in sobriety. For me, anyway, it was. You know, it was just like my family drove me crazy, and I drove them crazy, and it was like, it was just a bad scene. We were all together. You know, I'd go home and there wouldn't, you know, they'd throw out all the NyQuil and Robitussin and everything else, and I'd just pitch a fit, man. I'd just have to leave. And it was just a bad scene. And I was in there at the family night treatment, and I was going to not drink. And I felt like drinking so bad, but I was just going to white knuckle. I just was not going to drink. And I got home that night, and I was just not going to drink. And this is the best I could do. I was trying my hardest not to drink. Next morning, I woke up at like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I walked right down to the store, and I bought a 40-ouncer of something and drank it. And it was all I could do. I mean, I didn't even know that I was doing it. It's just like the big book talks about. I mean, I will drink no matter what. I have no mental defense against that first drink. This happened time and time again, and this happened for about the next year before I got sober. I have no mental defense against that first drink. None whatsoever. I mean, one meeting a week for me wasn't cutting it. Treatment wasn't cutting it. Family wasn't cutting it. All these people wanted me to be sober. I wanted to be sober. There was just absolutely no doing it on my own, you know. And over this next year, I'd come to realize that that was the situation. And they said, well, there's this place in Alaska that you can go. It's a long-term treatment center. You have to work there to pay for your whatever, your treatment, your counseling or whatever they got going. And there's horses and there's cows and it's beautiful and, you know, there's 10 feet of snow and it's 100 miles away from any drink. And so, you know, you might even be able to stay sober there. And so I finally just surrendered to the idea that I needed to be locked away somewhere not to drink, because there was just no way that I couldn't drink. I just couldn't. And so I agreed to go do it. And I flew up there and they poured me into this detox van and they took me to this treatment center called Nugent's Ranch in Wasilla, Alaska. And I was in detox and 3 or 4 days in there, and I'd finally got out of that, and I woke up and I realized it was just a pig farm in the middle of Wasilla. There was no horses, there was no cows. It was just a rickety old building, a rickety old shack with a bunch of weird looking people in there. And I didn't realize what I looked like, but I was one of those weird looking people. I hadn't looked at myself in a mirror in a long time, and there was this group there that was basically, you know, actively doing H&I work in this treatment center, and my soon-to-be sponsor Brad was in there, and he'd come drive a van and pick us up. And something about this guy, he had a light in his eyes and a spring in his step, and he was making fun of everybody that was in there, you know, patting him on the back, slapping him on the back, and it's just something about him that I liked the guy. There was something that he had what I want. Something about him is just like a confidence. I'm not even sure exactly what it was. And someone told me that if I asked him to be my sponsor, that he might say yes. And I wouldn't ask anybody, you know. I hate rejection, so I mean, I don't ask anybody anything unless I know the answer is going to be yes. And so I asked him, and he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, I was willing. And this time I was. I mean, I was just done. I mean, if you're new tonight, I just absolutely hope that you're desperate. I hope that you're so desperate you're willing to do absolutely anything that these people in Alcoholics Anonymous ask of you, because I was ready. I was absolutely ready to do anything. Then he said this, which I wasn't ready for. He said, okay, when it comes to your life, my thinking is better than your thinking. Now, I'd fashioned myself quite a thinker by this time. I mean, I really thought that I could figure stuff out. I always thought that more people should come seek out my advice, because I could just tell that there are areas I could really fix them up. You know, and so when he said that, I didn't say anything, but I was just thinking, yeah, whatever, you know. Pretty quick, he had me praying. He said, I want you to go home every night after the meeting. I want you to say, God, thanks for keeping me sober today. Amen. And get up in the morning and say, God, please keep me sober today. Amen. And I didn't believe in God. I was just venomously anti anything, religion, God, Jesus, anything. Just couldn't stand any of it for no good reason. You know, I'd never even really been to church before. But I just hated it, probably because there was just no way I could accept, you know, any kind of supreme being the way that I was living my life. It just wasn't possible. And so I'd consciously just separated myself from any kind of thought of a power like that in my life, you know. And I was certainly powerless over alcohol. My life was surely unmanageable. I mean, there was a hole inside me, a spiritual void inside me that could not be filled. There was just no way. You know, I had no defense against the first drink. I was, the way that I had lived my life, I lived it so poorly, I was going to AA, you know. My management clearly wasn't working anymore. And so he told me to do this, and I just did it. I didn't believe what I was doing, I just did it. I got up, and I said the prayer at night, I said the prayer, I just did it. And pretty quick, I started developing some resentments. There was this guy who slept next to me in this treatment center, and he was just a disgusting human being. He was, got up in the morning, he was in his underwear, he'd be praying on his underwear, a lot like Bob did. And I wasn't a get on your knees kind of prayer yet. And he just irritated me all the time. His name was Benny, and I just couldn't stand this guy. And, my sponsor said, well, you need to start praying for him. You need to say, God, please grant Benny thy best every morning and every night. And so I didn't want to do it. but I didn't believe in God, so I don't know why I didn't want to do it. I should have just done it. But so I started doing that, and about a week and a half later, he got kicked out of treatment for getting in a fight. And I was like, there is a God. You know, I believe in a higher power. Step three was my sponsor took me to his house, and we read 60 to 63 and got on our knees and said the third step prayer together, and I was completely weirded out by that. I was looking out the window. I just, you know, he lived alone, and I was sure somebody would peek in there and see us on our knees together praying. And he gave me a big hug afterwards, and we were driving back to the treatment center that I was staying at, and something changed. So I just all of a sudden started feeling good. I all of a sudden started feeling like I had actually done something. And by the time I got to that treatment center, I felt like I had really done something. I felt like I had turned my will and my life over to the care of God. I felt like I was, you know, I was walking on air. I walked into that pig farm, and I walked right in there, and I checked myself in, and I was sitting there contemplating what a wonderful thing had just happened. And there was a box of frozen tomatoes, and I was, you know, standing there, and I was throwing them at these chickens as I was contemplating how spiritual I was, beaming these chickens with these frozen tomatoes. I had no idea that I had just made a decision. You know, I had no idea that it was just the tip of the iceberg, that I had to do the rest of the steps, you know. But I'll tell you, something made me feel different. And I'm not an animal abuser, I'm so self-obsessed. I didn't even know what I was doing. And still in a fog, and I got, you know, and I was just a pain at meetings. I mean, I always wanted to share, and they didn't really want me to share. And I wanted to share why they were sharing. You know, I'd be talking to people during the meeting, and I hate it. You know, I always hate it because I'd be talking, and you know, my sponsor would go, shh. And he'd have this mean look on his face when he did it, you know, and I'd just be like, oh, you know, I'd just be mad at him. Or I'd be in the back of the room, and he'd be like, in front of everybody, he'd be like, come here, right here, sit in the front, you know, in front of all 10 of them. He'd hurt my feeling, you know, and I just hated that, and I was fighting it, and I just couldn't wait to get up there and share something. I had all this wonderful knowledge, and I'd get up there, and I'd start talking, and immediately my sponsor's hands would go up like this. Like I was done, you know, like I'm going to start clapping if you don't sit down. And I realized now I was a pain. And then I started developing all these opinions about the meeting. My sponsor, he always shared last, and he'd always share for longer than everybody else. And I started getting upset about that. Not knowing that he had to fill the time, you know, because there's only a few of us at the meeting. And finally, I pulled him aside, and I had to share my little epiphany with him about that. And he said, come here, we need to talk. And he took me in the back room, and he said, how much time sober do you have? And I told him, and he goes, how much time sober do I have? And I said, 9 years. And he said, don't you think I know a little something more about staying sober than you do? And I said, well, I conceded the point. You know, I said, well, yeah, I guess so. He said, we are not peers, you and I. You don't come, you're not my sponsor. You don't come tell me what to do. This meeting was going along just fine before you came along. You know, come to find out later, he didn't really like me that much, which I don't know why. I was such a good guy, always trying to contribute. Another time he'd come pick me up, and he made me, you know, he'd tell me, he said, you better be ready at 7. I'm coming to get you. Meeting starts at 8. You better be ready at 7. And one time, I was walking out there, it was about 7:05, I didn't think anything of it, you know, and all I could see was the back of his truck pulling out of the treatment center there. I learned real quick, I better be ready at 7. In fact, I better be ready before 7, because sometimes I couldn't be ready quite by 7. So I started realizing that on time meant about 10 or 15 minutes early, and he didn't even have to tell me that. I just kind of figured it out by the way he drove off when I wasn't ready, you know. I was a fairly quick study. And I was just, you know, I was just hateful. I mean, I did a fourth step and a fifth step, and I just felt disgusted with myself afterwards, because here is this, you know, I lived in a fairly sexually liberal community in Eugene, Oregon, and then there was this conservative Montanan cowboy sponsor that I had. So there's a few things I was afraid to share with him. So when we were doing that step, he said a little prayer, and, you know, then I, you know, he said, God, please help Andrew tell me that stuff. He's not planning on telling me. And I was thinking, how did he know that? And then if God was involved, I was like, well, God's going to know if I don't tell him. So I told him, and he just laughed. One of the things I told him, he's like, hell, I did that this morning. No, he didn't say that. Uh-oh, I'm getting this. That made me feel a lot better, but I was still disgusted with myself by the things that I had done, you know. And it really wasn't until I got to the ninth step. But before I got to the ninth step, I mean, I'd be in a meeting. I've always hated somebody in the group, always. You know, and the group was even growing a little bit by this time, and there was always somebody in there I just couldn't stand, you know. And there'd be a chairperson up there, and they'd call on this guy that I hated, and so now I'm mad at the chairperson for calling on the guy that I hated, you know. And then he'd get up and share and say something funny, and everybody'd laugh. And I'd be like, I need to change home groups. These people, they don't care about me at all, you know. And then one time I was so mad, I walked in there, and I was just angry, you know. And I walked in there, and my sponsor just saw it, a look in my eyes, and I was just so mad. It's just all that emotional stuff that we got going, you know. We're just crazy. And he taught me a long time ago to ignore my emotions. And every now and then, man, they're just so out of control, I can't even ignore them. I'm just going to, you know, explode on somebody. And he came up and he said, thou shalt not hit thy sponsor. And I just started laughing. And he just kind of diffused the situation, you know. He just had a way of doing that. And he always, you know, he'd chew on me pretty hard. But it seemed like he always left me, you know, I'd always feel better when we got done talking about stuff. And it was just amazing. He'd chew me up and spit me out. But then he'd say something nice, you know, right before he was done. He'd just knock me right down to the ground and step on me and squish me down like this. And then he'd, you know, step aside and be like, come on, get up. It's okay. You're doing good, kid. Come on, let's go. You know, and that's just, so I'd always, you know, kept the ego in check, but at the same time, he kept me feeling, you know, okay enough to come around the group. And the old timers were there. Ron was there, and he just always had something nice to say to me, like, you're a puke, you know. Always a kind word or gesture, and Robert was, you know, Robert always came up to me like this, and he said, you know, hey, you need to make the coffee earlier or whatever. If you know Robert, you know, he's got a taco neck. And the whole reason I joined the group was because Brad was dating this girl named Megan, and I wanted what he had. You know, that's the only reason I joined Northern Lights in the first place. You know, and then she was gone like a month later, and there I was, stuck with all these old Wasilla-billies, you know, just going to meetings. Got out of this pig ranch, and the first, you know, I heard about these fishing jobs and these all these jobs where you make all this money and you go work on the North Slope and 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, you know, and my sponsor would have none of it. None of it. I mean, he didn't entertain those ideas even for an instant. He goes, you're just way too sick to even think about not being at a meeting at least every day. So there's no way you're even going to come close to staying sober. He goes, absolutely not. Forget about it. Get a job where you can get to meetings. So I was looking all over for a job, and I got this job, this crappy job working at a gas station. You know, I'd go to the meeting after the meeting, and then I'd show up for work, and I was, you know, I'd clean the bathrooms, mop the floor, armor all the gas pumps, you know, make them all shiny, and there's in Wasilla, the wind's blowing like 50 miles an hour, it's like 40 below, freezing my ever-loving, you know what, off out there, you know, just hating it. And then Brad would come driving by laughing, pull in, get some gas, or some of the other guys from the group would come by and laugh at me. It was terrible, but I just kept going, you know, I just kept showing up no matter what. And I'll tell you what, that direction saved my life. There was no way I was going to make it if I was going to be one of those guys that went up and worked on the North Slope making all that money. And I carried that principle to this day. I never stopped doing that. I always took jobs, and never took jobs necessarily for the money, but always so that I could make my home group meetings and make the conferences and come to Beartooth. You know, he's been dragging me to Beartooth forever now, and I'm so glad he has. You know, the first one wasn't so good. The next one was incredible. And the next one after that, and the only reason the first one wasn't so good is, and I was still detoxing pretty much. You know, I was a year sober or something like that, but I was just, you know, if you're not having all that much fun, but I wanted to go back to the next one, even though I wasn't having that great of a time, so something must have sunk in, you know. So if you're new and you're not having that great of a time, it's keep coming back, because now this is the most, you know, I just love it here and love the people here. I wanted to be a police officer, you know. I mean, I just waffled. I was such a newcomer waffler. I was like, one week I wanted to, you know, I even thought a girl would dump me and I just want to be a priest. You know, women are just too much. You know, I'm just going to go be a priest or a minister. And And then the next week it was something else, and I wanted to be Jewish one week, and then I wanted to be this, and then I wanted to be a state trooper. And so this guy in the group that was involved in law enforcement pulled my record, and he came to me and he said, you know, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. He said, not only does it not look good, you're wanted in 4 states right now. And so I decided not to be a trooper. And, but pretty quick I had to tell my sponsor about that little development. And there were some things that happened that I never really got charged for, you know. Things never really happened. I never got arrested for, and I guess they'd just been waiting. Finally they did. Finally, I got charged, I guess. But I'll tell you what, by this time I was plugged in with you people. I was so plugged in with you people. My sponsor, it was just like, he just kept me so busy I couldn't even hardly think about doing anything but AA and work. So what we do is I got all these letters, and I got an attorney, and I got all these letters from everybody under the sun. By this time I was going to college, and, you know, Andrew's getting good grades, Andrew's showing up for work, he's been sober 2 years. I mean, it was like hundreds of letters we bombarded the DA with, and the DA was sitting in front of the judge, and my attorney was sitting there. It was Christmas Eve. I was with my sister, or the day before Christmas Eve, I was with my sister, and there was another guy there in court who was just like me, just hadn't changed. He was just like me. He just hadn't, you know, he hadn't been given the gift that I had been given. And he saw that, and he looked at my situation. He just said, no, we'll just dismiss everything. You're free to go. You know, and I still have that piece of paper from the judge. And I mean, that is just an amazing gift in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I still to this day, I get chills just thinking about it, because I should be locked up big time. And I guess God wanted me to do something else. He wanted me to work with newcomers. He wanted me to go to treatment centers and go to jails and carry this message. And I went to college. Everyone had always told me that I probably would do well if I would apply myself. And that I was, you know, that I was smart, and I was just a good test taker is really all it amounted to. I wasn't smart at all, and I found that out by going to college. I'd go, and everyone seemed to be doing good and understanding what was going on. I'd be reading these books and just clueless, you know, but you guys taught me to show up no matter what. And I don't even know why I went to college. It's just one of those things I never finished that is always in the back of my mind that I needed to do. You know, I went to school on and off for 4 years and got up to Alaska and got my credits transferred, and I had 12 credits, you know. And you guys taught me just to show up to class no matter what. And I mean, I swear to God, I had the best attendance record at the University of Anchorage, Alaska of anybody ever. I never missed anything. I never missed the studies. I never missed class. I never missed nothing. And, you know, I graduated with honors as a result of just showing up. And it was tough. I mean, I thought I was really stupid. Because I could not get it through my thick skull, but I graduated and did well just because I showed up and took the action, just like you guys taught me to do. A little while later, you know, the recovery group has been so instrumental, and I know that my sponsor sobered up here, and he started the Northern Lights group, which has just grown by leaps and bounds. It's just amazing. We were there. I chaired the meeting Tuesday night, and I don't know if there was close to 100 people in the room out in Wasilla, Alaska, you know, and it was everyone's on fire. And I moved to Anchorage when I was 5 years sober, and me and two other people started the Glacier Group in Anchorage, and now that's the biggest meeting in Anchorage, the Glacier Group is. And we have a speaker meeting on Wednesday nights at 8, and we have a kind of a different half speaker, half call-up meeting on Saturday nights, and people there are on fire, and we got that from you guys. John's been a great help to me. There's been twice I've been resentful at my sponsor. I know you guys never have been resentful at your sponsors before. And I called John, and John's, you know, walked me through it, did one inventory with him one time, and he's just been a huge help. And my sponsor was totally instrumental in helping me get that meeting going, because he had done that. He had walked it in front of me, and I have the fellowship I crave. I have, as a result of the old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous and the opportunity to work with the newcomers. And my life today, my schedule looks like this. You know, I got my 4 meetings. Every other week I do a treatment center panel in one of the meetings, and I say yes to AA whenever I get a chance to say yes to AA. I sponsor lots and lots of guys, and I love to sponsor them. I didn't like sponsoring anybody at first, but today it's like my favorite thing in the world is watching the guys get sober, watching them get back with their wives, get their kids back, pay child support. You know, that doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's cool. I like to see it, and I just can't be... I guess I can't say enough or be grateful enough for the people that came before me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just grateful to be sober today. Thanks.